If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello, you're listening to the BBC History Magazine podcast. I'm Dave Musgrove, the magazine's editor.
And I'm Sue Wingrove, the deputy editor.
Lovely to have you listening to us. This is the second of our two December 2009 podcasts. So coming up, we've got...
One of the things you have to do is ask yourself, why did the Viking Age begin when it did?
Well, that was Robert Ferguson, who's posing a very big question about the Vikings.
His range was extraordinary. He was a literary colossus, really.
And that was Peter Martin, who's talking about Dr. Johnson.
This podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, the UK's best-selling history monthly. We'll tell you how to get hold of a copy of the magazine later on.
Now, before we go to this month's interviews, let me just tell you what's on our website at the moment. Whether or not you buy the magazine, there's lots of free historical content to enjoy there. If you haven't visited it, please do take a look. There are special features to read, plus our guide to history on the TV, as well as an index to back issues of the magazine, a weekly quiz, and a forum for talking history. It's all at www.bbchistorymagazine.com.
And don't forget that we have more audio history on our website in the form of our Day Tripper series, where Julian Humphreys delves into the stories of some of Britain's historic towns. Just go to the Visit History section of the website and click on any of the Day Tripper pieces to hear the guides. Here's a clip from the guide to Ironbridge.
Why was the bridge built here in the first place, and why in iron? Well, the problem was that the area's industrial expansion was being hindered by the absence of a bridge across the gorge. The nearest one was about 2 miles away, and although half a dozen ferries regularly crossed the gorge, they weren't particularly reliable. Well, it was obvious that a bridge was needed, but the large numbers of barges and other vessels plying their trade up and down the river meant that whatever was built would need to be single span so as not to impede their progress.
And to hear more about that and other places to visit, go to www.bbchistorymagazine.com/visit/Ironbridge.
Now then, the Vikings. They've had a very variable reputation over the years, from the traditional view that they were bloodthirsty rape and pillagers, through to the revisionist take that they were more akin to adventure tourists. Clearly, it's a subject that's crying out for a nuanced viewpoint. Robert Ferguson has given us that in his feature in this month's issue of the magazine, where he examines what might have driven the Vikings to launch their vicious seaborne attacks. You've written about the Vikings in the current issue of BBC History Magazine, and you're talking specifically in the feature about what caused the Viking attack. So perhaps we ought to just clarify what we mean about when we say the word Vikings relating to the 8th and 9th century.
Yeah, who they were. Yeah, basically they were Norwegians, Danes, and Swedes, and these are real tribal identities. They're not sort of modern constructions. They were genuine. The people at those times knew who they were. There was a trader named Othaid from the north of Norway who turned up at Alfred the Great's court in about 880 and gave his court a sort of lecture about the geography and the population of these Scandinavian countries. And they were very clear. He was very clear. Norway, actually, his description of Norway is very like the Norway of today. So there were this was the basic. There were the Scandinavians, there were Norwegians, Danes, and Swedes. And then about the middle of our period, that's to say about 850, the composition, what we mean by Vikings, probably changes slightly, because then you get these huge armies coming over probably consisting, in the case of the British Isles, of mostly Danes, but with a large number of Norwegians in them. And then even later on, in Ireland as well, you get these armies acting as mercenaries with a lot of local people. You get Celtic Norse dynasties rising in Ireland and so on. So to begin with, you have these three fairly separate tribal groupings, but as it develops, you get much more mixed. You get much more mixed concept of what a Viking army was or who a Viking was.
So we've got these three groups in what's now Scandinavia. What else is going on in Europe at the time, at the close of the 8th century?
Well, I think you could say in the main that there are three major political powers in Europe and in Europe at that time. Excuse me. You've got Byzantium in the east, which had survived the breakup of the Roman Empire. You've got the Muslims, who had seen a great expansion, a territorial expansion, in the two centuries preceding the outbreak of the Viking Age under these caliphates, which took them eastward as far as Asia Minor, and they occupied the Iberian Peninsula and even made inroads into south of France. And and the third of the great powers was the Franks, who had established themselves as the dominant tribe among these successor tribes after the fall of the Roman Empire. So by the middle of the 8th century, most of Europe between the Elbe in the east and the Pyrenees in the west was under Merovingian, Frankish and Christian control. Our story really begins in many ways with the accession of Charlemagne as sole ruler of the Franks in 771. And in military terms, he halts the Muslim expansion into Europe. He drives the Arabs back across the Pyrenees. He establishes Frankish dominance in Spain and Gaul. And then from about 782 onwards, which is bringing us right up to the beginning of the Viking period, his chief preoccupation becomes the conversion to Christianity of the tribe on his northeastern border, and that's the Saxons, and that's, as it were, the buffer tribe between his empire and the Danes of the Jutland Peninsula.
Okay, so that's interesting, isn't it? Because when do we officially say the Viking period starts? Where do you stand on that?
Well, the Insular Viking Age. These things are very subjective. Every country will have its own idea of when the Viking Age starts. Norwegians will tend to started about 750, but that's just a general kind of ballpark thing of to do more with national identity, and it's not so closely. We started with this act of violence against Lindisfarne, the monastery at Lindisfarne, in 793. Mm. And you've got to start somewhere. I think that's probably a fairly reasonable place to start, because violence is such a characteristic of the Viking Age, and this was a particularly violent and brutal way to begin it.
So and so basically the accession of Charlemagne and his rule in Europe then does tie in quite closely with the way that we see the start of the Viking period. So he was putting pressure on the peoples of northern Europe, pressuring their way of life, their society, and I suppose their religion specifically. So what effect did that have on the Vikings then beyond their Saxon buffer zone?
Well, this is quite a localized area of very great tension up in the northeast there around this time. Charlemagne really, I think there was something like 22 campaigns. He really, really set that as the goal of his political and cultural goal was to force the Saxons to abandon their culture, their political system, their beliefs and everything, and make them part Christians and part of the Frankish Empire. The Danish king at the time was I think it was his sister, was married to the leader of the Saxons, a man called Widukind. And several times Widukind crossed the border and sought refuge from these campaigns of battles. And of course the standout event was in the middle of the 780s, that was this massacre of 4,500 unarmed Saxon prisoners who were first of all forcibly baptized and then beheaded. There was what we would now call ethnic cleansing. Vast groups of Saxons were moved away from problematic areas. And as I say, Widukind crossed the border two or three times, sought refuge among the Danes, and you can imagine the kind of one has usually empathy here, but it's not hard to do. Imagine the sort of effect that this would have on the Danes, and through them, of course, the people over whom they exercised a kind of a tributary relationship in Norway and Sweden. So that you can imagine the great tension and a kind of cultural fear. This is a sort of cultural imperialism, and they were afraid of it, as many a small culture. It's just quite a modern phenomenon, you see, yeah, it in the modern world. So that I think that they realized that what should they do about it? You know, this how should we deal with this? We're not we can't really face them militarily. We can't really face to face on the battlefield. What should we do about it?
So that really takes us into the crux of your thesis, I suppose, or at least part of your thesis is the fact that this fear of what Charlemagne and his Franks might do to the Vikings, having seen what they did to the Saxons, led them to start raiding. That's because they were led by fear.
Well, I think that is it's certainly a very, very interesting and fruitful way to look at, because I think one of the things you have to do is ask yourself, why did the Viking Age begin when it did? A lot of the reasons that are usually given for the onset of the Viking Age will point to things like overpopulation, or they will point to things like the practice of primogeniture, where only the eldest son could inherit, so that there were a lot of younger brothers with no land and nothing much to do. But that's not a situation that arises overnight. You have to really try to explain why it erupted when it did. And I think when you look at that, the way that Charlemagne dealt with the Saxons, which was and completely dismantling their culture, even by law, once he'd subdued them, death penalties for all sorts of things, like refusing to be baptized and so on, then I think that I think there's a very good case for saying that this was a kind of a act of asymmetrical warfare in modern terminology, almost even terrorism, in that you attack people because they're Christian, rather than, of course, you rob them as well. But what makes it okay to rob them with such brutality is that they are such hateful people, or they're represented something hateful. So that, you know, in many ways, that those, I think it is an anachronism, but you could almost think of some of those early raids as being terrorism, almost in a modern sense, that they kill people for what they represent as much as for the what they can rob from them, and they do it with what I would think is almost an overkill. It's too brutal. If all you're going to do is rob these people, it's too brutal. Why burn the churches down? Why not leave them standing? Because their treasures would be replenished that much more quickly, and they would be available to rob that much more quickly. If they were simply professional barbarians and robbers, then I don't think they would have shown such hostility towards the artifacts of Christianity, the manifestation of Christianity as an institution.
So that puts a slightly different spin on the way we see the people behind these raids, isn't it? I mean, we've kind of their reputation has gone up and down a bit in historiography, hasn't it? We started off maybe with them as just this view of these basically savages coming in, heathen people with no understanding or complexion of Christian culture who just wanted to rob, rape, pillage. And then kind of we moved away from that, didn't we? We took a slightly more liberal view on them, thinking they were really just interested in the cultures and they were they were voyagers. But now we're getting an entirely new nuance to it now from your perspective.
Yeah, but I think I think history is very often the product of the time in which the historian is living, and I think perhaps people in recent years had forgotten how much passion ethnic tensions can arouse. But then there are many examples, but for example, the former Yugoslavia in the 90s is a very obvious example. Even Northern Ireland, you suddenly realise what extraordinary violence and passion intercultural tensions and rivalries can excite. So I'm not suggesting that this is the only reason. I'm not suggesting that these other reasons necessarily must disappear. But I do think that this idea of cultural tension has not been introduced to an English language public at all. And I think given the world we're living in at the moment, I think we have a much greater, more empathic understanding of what it feels like for a small culture to be attacked by a larger culture, or to feel the pressures of cultural imperialism.
Okay, and just coming to an end, how bloodthirsty were the Vikings exactly? I mean, you talked about that the damage their raids committed, and Lindisfarne is the prime example. How bad were their raids on the people who they raided?
Well, in this first wave, which I guess it really goes from, let's say, 790 to maybe the middle of the 9th century, which is when a slight change comes over the phenomenon. I think that they were characterized by, as I say, quite literally overkill. I mean, there's that incident in 806 when Iona, that remote monastery, which is one of the most holy places of northern Christianity, attacked for about the third time in 806. And 68 people, precisely the analysts give the number 68 people. It's a terrible, it's a small number of people, but it's also an extremely large number of people, if you think about it. And these were unarmed monks. They weren't expecting, why kill them? Why not just rob them? I think that everything points to a sort of hatred, which is over and beyond what you would normally expect from robbers who simply wanted money.
Yeah.
But as I say, once in the middle of the 9th century, I do think there is a qualitative change that comes over it when they realise how wealthy, particularly England, is. And they realise also that it's doesn't have a centralised monarchy. Its defences are split. The dream of conquest begins to enter their head as a people at about that time. So that, and what persists, of course, is the fact that they are on opposite sides of the cultural divide. They remain pagans. The analysts always refer to them, and Alfred's biographer Asser, for example, and the Einhard, Charlemagne's biographer. These for them, it is always a battle between pagans and Christians. They're very rarely referred to by their tribal identities. It's always the religion, it's always the culture that they represent. And in the middle of the 9th century, as I say, the dream of conquest arises when they realise there's fabulous wealth to be gained, and possibly even countries and crowns.
One last question. Give us the Scandinavian perspective on this. How impassioned a subject is this, the Vikings and who they were in their homelands?
It's their history, so they have a slightly different perspective on it. I mean, they identify, rightly or wrongly, this is rather silly after 1,200 years to talk about them and us, but it's instinctive, really. They regard the Viking as being their forefathers, and of course they're rather fond of the idea of them being great craftsmen, and they're proud of them. But I think this idea that I'm promoting here, I won't pretend it's an original idea, but it's been voiced a couple of times by some very prominent Norwegian archaeologists, Bjørn Myhre in particular. And I think this, given the times we live in and what's happening and on the world stage, I think people are more and more realising that there must be a place for this explanation for the outbreak of Viking violence in the 790s. They're proud of their, I can speak most about the Norwegians, of course. I think they're proud of them. They regard them really as the tearaways, you know. They disapprove of them, but with a sort of a wink, you know, that this was, you know, not bad ancestor to have, really.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings, that frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest, whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/historyextra. Just go to Indeed.com/historyextra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
That was Robert Ferguson. His feature is in the December issue of the magazine. He is author of The Hammer and the Cross, A New History of the Vikings, which is published now by Alan Lane.
And now, on to our next interview. Samuel Johnson was widely regarded as the leading literary figure of his time, and he was born 300 years ago this year. The work for which he is perhaps most famous is his Dictionary of the English Language, published in 1755. However, he was also a poet, biographer, essayist, editor, and a reviewer. Earlier, I spoke to biographer Peter Martin, who's written a feature on Johnson in our December issue. Peter, could you start by telling us a little more about the range of Johnson's literary endeavour?
His range was extraordinary. He was a literary colossus, really. He wrote essays, poetry, biography, works on travel, political pamphlets, for several of which he got into real trouble, particularly with the American audience, because he wrote against the American war of revolution. He wrote sermons, fables. He was also a journalist, editor of Shakespeare. He wrote many letters, kept diaries. And all of this, in spite of complaining all his life that he was lazy, and feeling great guilt that he was wasting his time and not deserving the talents that God had given him. But he had great powers of concentration when he did work. So he achieved an incredible amount, and the Yale edition of his complete works runs to many volumes.
If someone wanted to find out a little more, what would you suggest they read of Johnson's own work? Where would be a good place to start?
The best place to start with reading, getting to know Johnson through his writings, is his essays. His essays are very powerful. They seem to be as vital and as useful and as engaging today as when he wrote them in the 1740s.
Now, you touched a moment ago upon his sort of exacting standards and his thought that he was perhaps a bit lazy. What else do we know about the man himself?
Well, we know about his schools, his boyhood, friends and illnesses. He says in one of his diaries that he was born almost dead. His one year at Oxford, which ended unhappily because he ran out of money. We know a lot about his family, his father, his brother. His brother committed suicide. His marriage to Elizabeth Porter, whom he called Tetty, and who was 20 years older than he. We know a lot about his general health. Johnson had a habit of writing generously about his health and his physical problems. His travels, especially with Boswell in the Hebrides in 1773, we would know a good deal more if he had not actually burned most of his papers and many of his books 2 or 3 weeks before he died in 1784.
And why do you think he did that?
He felt this huge accumulating guilt all his life for all kinds of things. Much of it was religiously shaped. A lot of it had to do with this sense that he, you know, was wasting time, that he was indolent and lazy. He had certain overplayed and overstated problems or guilt over sexual relations. So I think he just wanted to wipe the slate clean. He even burned his mother's papers. The one person whose letters he saved were Mrs. Thrale's, Hester Thrale, who became a very good friend of his in the early 1760s and remained so until shortly before he died, and with whom he had a complicated relationship, as he did with Boswell, really.
Yes, now let's go on to Boswell, because you mentioned him earlier. His Life of Johnson, of course, is one of the great biographies of English literature. What does it tell us about Johnson?
As a matter of fact, I mean, you know, Johnson is perhaps the second most frequently quoted English author after Shakespeare. And most of what we quote of Johnson's that is not in his writings, conversation among his friends in the famous literary club that he founded with Sir Joshua Reynolds, most of that comes straight out of Boswell. But Boswell had facts that he wanted to suppress, and he did, for example, almost completely suppress the relationship Johnson had with Mrs. Thrale, who was probably his greatest confidant. She knew things about his emotional life, that nobody else did. Boswell doesn't tell us much, for example, about Johnson's profound emotional problems. He doesn't tell us about some of his great fears. He does touch on Johnson's melancholia. He keeps talking about that. Johnson suffered severely from melancholia, as well as from something that we now call Tourette's syndrome. His melancholia pervaded his life from the very beginning. He tried to exorcise that, too, through the long walks that he took, frequently between Birmingham and Litchfield, which is about 20 miles. And he emerged finally through a translation he did called The Voyage to Abyssinia. But then, in the early 1760s, he suffered another deep mental crisis, a sense of oppression and grayness and inertia, from which he was rescued, I think, at that point by Mrs. Thrale and Mr. Thrale, who took him off to their home in Streatham Park, and there nursed him pretty much back to health. And the last 20 years or so of his life, he can almost say that he lived there much of the time. He had his own room and that sort of thing. He had sexual guilt, too, undocumentable. And this pervasive sense of a fear of death, Boswell ignored. It was a really big problem Johnson had. He generally feared he would not go to heaven, that he would go to hell.
It's very sad, isn't it, that someone that we think of as such a sort of brilliant, successful literary figure should have felt so dissatisfied, really.
I think he was dissatisfied in these ways that I've just mentioned.
Yes.
But he had great satisfaction and fulfillment in his friends. He had a deep fund of humor. Boswell records his sense of humor better than anyone else. He had a robust sense of life, and he had a great sense of satisfaction in his literary success later. His marriage was a failure, and Boswell ignores that. His movements were wild. I mean, he suffered from Tourette syndrome. He had tics and gesticulations, made odd noises, and society was a bit awkward with him, to be with him and that sort of thing. But, you know, I don't want to underplay that. But you ask about what Boswell suppressed, and this is perhaps the major thing that he did suppress, because Johnson was Boswell's hero. And although it wasn't a whitewash, indeed, Boswell's great contribution to biography was that he wrote the first significant biography, comprehensive biography, which was not hagiography or a whitewash. This inner life of Johnson's he ignored.
Now, finally, 300 years after his birth, how do you think we should remember him today, and what can we learn from him?
We should remember him, I think, as the great essayist. And it isn't just a matter of memory. We have these essays. They number about 400 in all. I've got a lot of them in my new edition. Because out of this misery, this agony, if you like, that Johnson, this understanding of human nature, the appreciation of human foibles, of vanity and pride, of fear, greed, all of these human qualities. Johnson's understanding of these fed into his essays. And he doesn't write them in a preachy way. We call them Johnson's moral essays, but they're not preachy. He assures the reader that we are all on the same boat and that we can talk about these things. And in the process of talking about them in this magnificent style of his, this rhythmical, beautifully phrased style, he's able to unfold a great deal about us all. You often feel uncomfortable when you read them because you recognize their truth about yourself. But at the end of them, without any moralizing in a didactic sense, Johnson gives us at the end a sense of a more complete sense of who we are. And it's very tragic. I mean, it really is tragic that this great author, he's a cultural icon among English-speaking peoples, native English-speaking peoples, and especially in this country, is not now read much in schools. He's almost totally absent in A-level reading, for example, as he once was not. And so You know, if people grow up, you know, and they find themselves at universities and then leave universities without even having heard of Johnson, much less read him. And that is a very great shame.
Peter Martin's book, Samuel Johnson, A Biography, is published by Phoenix, while Samuel Johnson's Selected Writings is published by Belknap Press. BBC History Magazine is published each month. You can find it in all good newsagents in the UK for just £3.80. Or you can save money and make sure that you never miss an issue by taking advantage of one of our great subs deals, whether you're in the UK or live overseas. Details are on the website, and that is at www.bbchistorymagazine.com.
So, we're done for another month, and in fact, another year. We're going to go back to being monthly in 2010, so there'll just be one podcast a month, unless there's an outcry from our merry band of listeners demanding that we carry on with two podcasts. In the meantime, of course, let me wish you, if you celebrate such things, a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Our first podcast of 2010 will take a quick spin through a history of the world in 100 objects, stare into the toilet bowl of history with Thomas Crapper, and find out what was in the medicine cabinet of 18th century households.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.